happening is you've got twice the VA that you would have across 110 to 220 is twice the VA. So for the same amount of current, the transformer is getting twice the amount of load. There again, similarly on three-phase systems, if you have line to neutral, that's one loading, then you go line to line, you're 1.732 times more load on the transformer. So it's not so much that there's a pulsing reaction between the lines, it's just that the power in VA, as the voltage is increasing across the loading circuit, basically creates more of an overload on the transformer. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, let me run this one by again with you, Glenn. If I measure it on a three-phase circuit, line to ground, and I get some particular voltage, and then I go line to line, I'm going to measure a higher voltage, and the ratio is square root of 3. That's the 1.7 you just mentioned. If the voltage is 1.7 times higher line to line, that means the current capability is 1.7 times higher. That means the volt amperes is potentially 3 times higher. If I create the exact same number of ohms of fault line to line versus line to ground, I think potentially there could be 3 times the volt amperes. Am I anywhere close to right on that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
In RMS value, the current in the breaker should be limited to the RMS value. So if it is a 20 amp breaker, 20 amps RMS is where it should trip, let's say. Now, if you have one in each line, okay, the weakest sister is going to go first. So if you're going line to line, it still should be the 20 amps RMS before it. Now, might there be more impulse energy? So maybe if you're looking at the impact in time, yeah, chances are you'll have more energy capability at the moment that the short is created. But in true RMS value, the current should be the same on the breaker, whether it's going line to line or line to neutral. So the only thing that could be different is the impulse energy because of the lag time for the breaker to trip. Does that make sense, Dick? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, for the most part, I agree with that. But you are now talking about the fault creating extra stress on the transformer. The transformer that feeds that circuit breaker experiences a certain number of volt ampere load if I create a line-to-ground fault, line-to-neutral fault. But if I create a line-to-line fault, I think the transformer could be subjected to 3 times the amount of volt amperes. See if you agree with that one, Glenn. K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm not following that one right now, because if the voltage, in other words, it's VA, so if the amperes are limited by the circuit breaker, and the circuit breakers are in series with each line, and if the line-to-line is still limited by the circuit breaker, the current should be the same. And if I go line-to-neutral, the current is the same. So the power, the increase in power in VA, would basically be V volts times amps. So the amps are fixed by the breaker, and the voltage is increasing by the ratio of the square root of 3, or 1.732. So I see the 1.732 going times the current, and then if I just have the, you know, line to neutral, it's just the original rate, the square root of 3 less than that. So I'm not seeing the greater than 2:1. Maybe you can explain that one thing. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, let's assume that my house is wired in the Con Ed manner. There are certain portions of Queens and Staten Island where you don't get one-phase power, 110 volts each side of earth and 180 degrees between the two. The black and the red lead have 240 volts, but each one is 120 to ground. That's the one-phase type power that I've got in Suffolk County. But Con Ed, in certain areas of Queens and in Staten Island, they give you the equivalent of a red and a black wire, but they're 120 degrees apart, not 180 degrees apart. Each one is something like 120 volts to ground, but line to line is not 240, it's 207, 208 actually, square root of 3 higher. So if I've got two phases of three-phase power, 120 degrees apart, coming into my house, and I create a fault to ground, I'm creating a fault of, let's say, 20 amperes on 120 volts to ground. But now if I create a exact same 20 ampere volt with a different load resistor, a 20 ampere volt from line to line, it's 20 amperes at 207 volts, not 120 volts. Therefore, it is square root of 3. No. Let me think now. So it's square root of 3 higher in volt amperes. It's not 3 to 1. Okay. I'm beginning to agree with you. It's a higher number of volt amperes, but it looks like it's square root of 3 higher in volt amperes. If I got the right kind of right at the limit load. See if you agree with that one, Glenn. KQRIW.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was thinking. And where it's actually more severe is in the standard single phase where, let's say, if you have 120, 240, because line to neutral is 120, and then you have basically line, the, you know, which the double the ratio for 240. So there is a true 2-to-1 increase for the same breaker size. So I would think that if you have a 220 short, the loading factor back on the transformer is going to have a much larger overload than line to neutral, you know, by a factor of 2-to-1 there. So I think there really is the VA difference that's probably really causing the more severe loading back to Con Ed or to LIPA, or whoever the utility might be. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The arc fault breaker, is it literally looking for the arc as an optical event, or does it somehow detect the arc from phase to phase, and it's got a separate detector circuit in there as well as the phase to ground detecting circuit? What extra hardware do you believe has been added to a arc fault breaker? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
I'm not a real expert on the breakers, Dick, but the little that I do know about them is that they're basically like spring-loaded devices. There's like a bimetallic material and spring, and they're really more looking at thermal events. So realistically what happens with these breakers are they're like delay time. In other words, the arc fault versus the standard, if you look at a data sheet on them, which doesn't really explain much of the mechanics inside the breaker, but where you kind of get an idea of what might be going on there is the delay time. So in other words, your standard breaker is very, very slow. I mean, some of them actually have delay times almost in seconds. That's how long, in other words, if you were to put the overload at the true RMS value or slightly above the breaker, it could take seconds to trip it, whereas some of the arc fault breakers are actually in the tens of milliseconds. So there's a big ratio difference in terms of the time to trip. So I would believe that more likely what's happening there is that the spring tension to trip is a much shorter time lag. So it's really the time lag, and it's a faster blow type of breaker. In that instance, where the other type of breaker, which is the ground fault interrupter, is actually just looking for an increased current into ground, which it actually just trips open the breaker immediately if it sees a current into ground. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I think it is recommended that if you have a receptacle on the outside of your house that you could power things in the backyard, that you should definitely be using a GFI type to give you protection, because a person could be operating an appliance, the neutral or the grounding wire might become disconnected, he's standing on wet grass and touching the case of an instrument. If now you are doing the unrecommended thing, you've had a power outage, you've disconnected your main circuit breaker between you and the rest of the street, and you're using a motor generator set in the backyard and you're back-feeding that receptacle. Not recommended, but people have done it. I'm now feeding that GFI in reverse. To your knowledge, does it still provide the same kinds of protection when you're feeding it in reverse as to when you're feeding it in the forward mode? Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Well, the ground fault interruption outlet looks for current into ground. So if the ground loop isn't connected back to the main, so in other words, if you're just connected through the pin, there is no ground fault interruption protection. So you still have current protection of the circuit breaker back on the main panel. So if there's an overload in terms of maximum current, but my understanding, if you're back feeding and you're grounded to the pin, there's no intelligence in that circuit to determine any leakage to ground at that point. So because it wouldn't be cut, in other words, the source of current is in the wrong direction at that point. So I think you don't have ground fault protection from the generator to that ground. So theoretically, yeah, you would have to be very, very careful touching the case of that generator to any local grounds around there, because you could get quite a shock there. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I believe the recommended procedure, let me drop it. When you're running a motor generator set in the backyard, I believe the recommended procedure is you should be running a separate ground rod on the generator for a bunch of reasons. I think it would increase the safety of the GFI, and it certainly increases your safety when you touch that generator. In theory, the generator with very poor wiring could become 120 volts hot to ground, to earth, when you're backfeeding that way. It's not the recommended procedure, but lots of people do it. John, what's the latest experiment that you've been running in your laboratory since you've been doing some great things? I know that you and I have had some discussions on your Wimhurst machine and my Wimhurst machine. I've given some further look, by the way, at that electrostatic voltmeter of mine, which does have four scales. There are four click positions where I can push that rod into the machine, and it gives you four separate scales. 30 kilovolts is the highest scale, and I think the lowest scale is something like 5 kilovolts. And it's a very nonlinear lower end of every one of those four scales. The upper end is nice spread out, and the lower end is kind of crunched together. So you can tell I'm not very enthusiastic about changing the size of the vane inside that moves on this electrostatic voltmeter. The nice thing about this 30,000 volts electrostatic voltmeter of mine, let me drop, is that when you're measuring 30,000 volts, it doesn't draw one microampere, not even one nanoampere. It literally measures the electrostatic repulsion that occurs when a high voltage is near a movable vane that's on a Dawson valve meter movement like thing. So it's the one meter in the world that can measure voltage without drawing current. Almost every other meter I've ever seen can't do that. Very few. I guess it's a kind of an electrometer. There is something, a piece of electronics that used to be popular called an electrometer. By the way, I'm going to answer that one question that somebody had earlier, and that is, what is the fancy thing about my house? My house was built in 1957. It's had very little updating over that time. And in 1957, they put cartridge fuses in the main fuse panel for the house. Cartridge fuses. I don't have circuit breakers. And when I went from homeowner policy A to homeowner policy brand A to brand B, they were asking me the question, do you have cartridge fuses or circuit breakers? And they were alarmed by the fact that it had cartridge fuses, to which I said, don't you realize cartridge fuses are probably more reliable? That circuit breakers have got a whole lot of failure modes. And eventually, I think I convinced them that that's not a problem. If anything, it's even greater safety on this older house that they were about to insure. You might have a comment on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
My house has a screw-in fuse. This is KB2MAR.
Yeah, I've got screw-in fuses as well as cartridge. The main fuse is a cartridge with a great big handle on it. You pull out into your hand, and then when you pull it out, you're looking at a pair of 60-ampere or 100-ampere fuses. And then the rest of the panel are screw-in fuses. Over to you, Glenn. Looks like Glenn is gone. So I think they could be more reliable. Circuit breakers have got a number of failure modes, whereas ordinary fuses, the screw-in fuses and the cartridge fuses, I think, do not. I think they're much more fail-safe. That's a belief. Now, as I said, that was a meter that draws no current, and that's required because this Wimhurst machine, this thing that looks like two great big clear discs that rotate in opposite directions toward each other with a bunch of tinfoil strips on it, and that thing can generate an easy 100 kilovolts, and I think I'm getting close to 200 kilovolts out of that thing. But my voltmeter only goes to 30 kilovolts, and I thought of various ways of putting a voltage divider on it. Well, the voltage divider is going to be a resistive network that draws current. And the good news about a Wimhurst machine is it can generate 100 or 200 kilovolts of voltage. That's the good news. The bad news is it has an internal impedance of about 10 to the 11 ohms. That's, let me think. That's 100,000 megohms is the internal impedance of the machine. You put a fingerprint across those plastic discs in between those pieces of tinfoil, and you're partially shorting out the machine. It doesn't produce as good a voltage. On a dry day, you get a lot more voltage out of the machine than you do on a high humidity day. In fact, on some high humidity days in the summertime, it's a real pesky thing to try to make the thing even start up at all.
Isn't that a gigohm?
A gigohm would be 10 to the 12 ohms. Oh, no, then 10 to the 9 ohms is a gigohm. A teraohm. 10 to the 12 ohms is a teraohm. So it's 100 gigohms. 100 gigohms. You're right, John. If it's 10 to the 11 ohms, I think I did that calculation once, it's 100 gigohms of internal resistance of that machine. So on a high humidity day, the humidity sitting on those discs is a partial short circuit, and it almost doesn't work. So you're going into the winter months where you're going to get some nice aspiration out of it, John. You probably don't have a humidifier in your laboratory, nor with a source of moisture. And so you'll get some real good operation, particularly when you loosen up those acorn nuts and you start moving those shorting bars. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Well, Dave, first of all, I think you're right about fuses. They are much more reliable than circuit breakers. Absolutely. The only problem is the old cartridge fuses were pretty safe as long as you kept the tines tight. Those screw-in fuses were the nemesis because people would just upgrade them. They had a simple Edison base until they went over to Fusetrons, which had a specific base for each size fuse. So in your case, you could put a light bulb in there, a penny in there, and that's the real issue with fuses. If they're left alone, they're perfect. No, I've never had things burn up with fuses like I've had with breakers. Much more damage with breakers. Back to you.
And you've said something very interesting. I never realized that the thread is the same as a light bulb, that I could screw a light bulb in there, which would make a very nice current limiting device. If I'm about to test some circuit, then I'm not sure whether or not it's a 10-watt circuit that could be a short circuit. If I plugged in a 100-watt light bulb, then the light bulb would simply light up if I had a short circuit on that 10-watt load. Very, I didn't realize that. Ah, that's the same thread. And yes, if somebody's foolish enough to put a penny behind there, wow. Now, you had failures of circuit breakers that created damage. Give me a couple of words on that. What do you believe? I guess the circuit breaker failed. It arced itself into the closed mode forever. And maybe it's one that had been switched a whole lot of times under load. And we now know that that inrush current can really do some terrible things to the actual context of a circuit breaker. So give us a couple of words on the circuit breaker failure that you've experienced, John, probably on some of those Navy circuits. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Well, I'll give you a quick rundown with circuit breakers. You and Glenn are absolutely right. They're not meant to be used for switches. But in my case, it's okay because I'm dealing with very low amperage. There's not one circuit breaker that has more than 5 amps running on it, 3 amps maybe. So there you get away. And Paul was mentioning these knife switches. Now, they're not meant to open under load either. The only thing that's meant to open under load are contactors, and they close on load. Those are mechanically held, magnetically pulled in type contactors, big stuff. So because if you had a disconnect switch and you had a load and you go to close that switch, years ago there was a way to close it. It accelerated the motion of the blades as you came up to the high point and then it would snap in. But I'm sure you're aware of the old Frankenstein switches, which was a little handle and you had 3 blades and it was open front slate switchboards, which are still in existence today. When you pull those open, it's dangerous under load. So they're really not meant for that.
And even if you've got a rapid disconnect, if you've got the kind that toggles very rapidly because of an internal mechanism, even that is not going to give you complete protection on both make and break because my load could be a highly inductive load, like a motor, and during the brake operation, I get an inductive kickback that gives me 1,000 volts on a 120-volt circuit, and now you've got 1,000 volts arcing across those contacts as they're separating. And so it's just a matter of a number of cycles before they're going to experience a significant amount of damage. I'll pass it over to you for that one before I give you another piece of information along these lines. Over to you, John.
Well, you're absolutely right, Dick. If you could realize if you had like 30 tons of air conditioning and you closed a switch with that air conditioner in the on mode, the problem is the inrush current could be 1,300, 1,500 amperes. The copper is just not meant to take that on its small contact area of maybe the first quarter of an inch, and you can actually blow chunks out of the switch doing that. So there are procedures that you must follow, and you're absolutely right. Everything should be used according to the specifications of the manufacturer, but I stretch it a little bit because it's much more convenient, and it saves having all of these switches taking up room on my wall. I'd have 40, 50 switches, and you know, little toggle switches, so I got away with that.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, when you give a good hard look at your Wimhurst machine, I think you're going to find that those shorting bars that are at right angles to each other, each one is 45 degrees compared to the desk, I think you're going to find that they are not indexed in any way. It is being held in position by the tightness of the acorn nuts that are on the forward end and the rearward end of that shaft that goes to the middle. And the shaft itself has got a step inside so that you can tighten those acorn nuts without them over-tightening the bearing that's on the actual rotating plates. The rotating plates still rotate free even though you tighten those acorn nuts. It's a very nicely designed thing. Yours has an extra plastic bar in the front that mine doesn't have. My output probes are suspended from the Leyden jar. The two Leyden jars are supplying mechanical support as well as electronic capacitance. And yours has an extra plastic bar out front. But as you look at that real close with a magnifying glass, I think you're going to find there's no real indexing on those crisscross shredding bars. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
I believe you're right, Dick. I think it's just compression that's holding them in place. And if I loosen those acorn nuts, I'm sure I could move them. I just haven't gotten around to that yet because I'm still like a little kid with a toy. But I believe you're right. And if you want to, I'll go on about the circuit breakers.
Yeah. And when you do rotate those, make sure that the machine is being turned slowly while you do it. That way you won't be backing up on the brushes and potentially kinking them. You don't want to kink those brushes. Now, in the mode that you're in right now, or even in the mode that when you rotate those shorting bars, if you operate it in a dark room, after your eyes are dark adapted, as you turn the handle, you're going to see a whole bunch of corona occurring around the pieces of tinfoil, and the corona is occurring in between the U-shaped pickup brushes and the nearest shorting bar. That 45 degree rotation area on the disc is where the full voltage to ground exists, and what's the maximum voltage the machine can generate is limited by the amount of corona you get in that area on both the left hand pickup U-shaped brush and the right hand U-shaped pickup brush. Both of those have a certain distance to their nearest shorting bar, and that's where the voltage limitation takes place. If you put the contacts far enough apart, the machine doesn't get a chance to arc, and it doesn't allow you to lose your dark adaption of your eyes. And you turn the machine when it's in full operation, you're going to see that arcing taking place between those pieces of tinfoil. KC2WGB, KQRIW.
KC2WGB. Well, what I tried to do, Dick, I darkened the room and I took my camera. That's the same camera that took the pictures that you're looking at. It's a fair camera. And it's a digital camera. I was trying to take pictures, but I don't have a full position which allows the lens to stay open. So it didn't help. So I'm going to have to bring out either my Hasselblad or the Leicas and use film to do that. I can leave it on long exposure, leave that wheel turning in total darkness, and with fast film, I should be able to get a beautiful picture of all the arcing that's taking place throughout the disc and the electrodes.
I wasn't saying you got to photograph it, John. when your eyes are dark adapted, if you've got reasonably normal vision, you will see it visually with no problem. Back to you.
No, I just wanted to photograph it, you know, for the edification of others. So that everybody's interested in it. Everybody that comes in here wants to play with it. So I'd like to show them actually what's happening with photographs, if I can do that. I'm going to try it.
KC2QIQ with an idea?
Go ahead, Glenn.
I was going to suggest, John, that if you have a video camera that you can set up on a tripod near the area and focus it in right on that area with light, and then do a light balance adjustment for darkness, and run the video camera and while you're creating the arcs. And usually the video camera catches quite a bit. It's just a matter of you know, tricking the camera to know the light balance for the background. You know, so you set the focus with light on, and then once the focus is good, then you turn the lights off and then readjust the white balance, and usually you can get it to operate pretty well in darkness and get the video camera to pick up all those arcs and sparks in real time. I'm going to pass it back to Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
See, Dick, he embarrassed me.
Yeah, with the various kinds of camera, whether it be a video camera with a charge-coupled device screen, or whether it be an old-fashioned film, a motion camera, in either case, you're moving at a, you're taking pictures of a moving target that is coronaring. The discs are continuously rotating. Therefore, you're going to get a kind of a smear. It'll be an exciting-looking picture, but it will not be easy to interpret. When you do it with your eye can stop the motion periodically, so to speak, particularly when you wiggle your eyes back and forth in ways you're not even aware you're wiggling them. And as such, you will see the corona taking place around individual foils on the disc. I guess it's possible also. I know that the guys who are doing astrophotography with that 2U cam, this is a camcorder, no, it's a, I can't think of the name that they were used when you've got a camera aimed at you and you and your buddy are both sitting in front of a computer and you're sending visual pictures back and forth. That function, for those kind of cameras, you can make it take, 100 frames per second, individual frames. And now if you look at those individual frames, you probably can stop the motion. But the corona around each of those pieces of tinfoil, when the motion is stopped, could be kind of exciting looking. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Glenn just mentioned something. I forget that this camera of mine, this Sony that I have, does video also. I've never used it. I've only used it for still photography. I never even thought of it. Wow. That's crazy. That's the next thing I'll try tomorrow. That might work well. But the film that I would be using, I'd probably use the 27D, which is extremely fast. I just want to see the circle of arcs. I won't be able to see one arc in that film, but I will be able to see the tracking as it goes around. That will probably be nice to look at.
I think you're saying you haven't tried yet to see it with your naked eye. Is that true, John?
No, I did not. I did take a look at with the naked eye at the probes themselves when I had disconnected the shorting bar and connected it back to look at the corona in the dark, but I wasn't paying attention to the wheel. That's what I'll have to look at. I haven't tried that yet with the naked eye.
And I'm not sure if you get the most amount of corona on the wheel, on the individual pieces of tinfoil, when the shorting bar between the Leyden jars is connected or not connected. There, I'm not sure. I'm reasonably sure you get the maximum arcing when you've separated the probes far enough so that you don't get a spark. Then the machine goes to maximum voltage. Have you ever been able to understand how the machine builds up voltage, how this influence machine, why it's called an influence machine? Have you been able to figure out how it bootstraps itself and builds up a high voltage? I'm going to ask John first and then Glenn in that order. I've seen a number of websites that try to explain it, and when you buy it, and by the way, I ought to tell people that if you're interested in a Wimshurst machine, you just Google the word Wimshurst, W-I-M-S-H-U-R-S-T, I think is the way it's spelled. A guy way back in 1860 invented this machine. At the time, it's one of the few ways of making high voltage. You Google those words, you'll find a whole lot of websites. If you go to Amazon with those words, they will show you five different companies selling them, starting at numbers these days like $79 and going up to a couple of $100, depending on how much quality and a mahogany base and whatever you want to buy. But it's kind of a fun machine. When it comes to how it builds up the high voltage, there's a little data sheet they ship you, make it clear to you, Glenn. For a long time, I didn't quite understand it. I mean, I said John first. KC2WGB, KQLIW.
Dick, the only thing that came with the machine was the instructions on how to insert the handle. That's it. Nothing else. So I was on my own. But I believe, in my opinion, that it's the same as the carpet and rubbing your shoes. The brush picks up excess electrons, and they're collected in the light jars, and it just keeps building. That's my impression.
Good guess, but that's almost a no on that one, John. Almost a no. That would give you a certain voltage buildup, but nowhere near as high, and it wouldn't be an exponential rise. If you plotted the voltage versus time as you turn the handle on the machine, you'll find out that the voltage is a very low slope curve in the beginning. And pretty soon the machine starts building up a higher voltage, and now the slope of voltage versus time starts increasing. It becomes a parabolic curve. It's an exponential rise until it starts coronering. If you could stop it from coronering, it would go to a megavolt 2 seconds after it was at 200 kilovolts, if you know what I mean. From 0 to 100 kilovolts takes quite a few seconds. From 100 kilovolts to 200 kilovolts is probably 1 second. It's got a very fancy exponential rise phenomenon. Wonder if you're familiar with how it works, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW, have you ever owned one?
No, I've never owned one, Dick. My understanding of how the operation of that is that it's a charge displacement device, where basically you have metal plates on one ring on one side and another set of metal plates equally spaced on another plate opposing on the other side, where they're connected alternately through brushes that they run through. So as you run the ring, these plates through the brushes in opposite directions, what you're doing is you're displacing charge across plates, and you're alternating the connections through the brushes. So as you run it through, the charge that's displaced on the first ring gets transferred to the second one, and as you keep on rotating the device, you're displacing the charge across multiple plates in opposite directions. So what's happening is the faster you move the device, the quicker the charge is being transferred to the next plate, and then building and adding as that machine keeps on rotating. I know that's a very, very poor description of what's going on, but basically it's charge displacement. That, at least that's my understanding there. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I think you're very close, Glenn. If I had an electroscope in front of me, that's one of these machines where you've got this sealed container, you've got a rod coming out of the top of the container with a ball on the top of the rod. Inside the container on the bottom of the rod, you've got these two gold leaf sheets. As you rub a piece of fur on a plastic rod so that you're building up a high static charge on the rod, let's assume the rod becomes positive. I'm not sure if I got it right, positive or negative, but I'm rubbing a piece of fur on the rod, and the rod is building up a static charge. And I now bring the tip of the rod close to the ball on the top of the electroscope. I don't even touch it. I just bring it close. And immediately the two gold leaves inside will separate. What has happened is that there's a certain number of positive and negative charge that are on that rod coming out of the top of the electroscope. You bring a strong positive charged rod nearby. It repels the positive charges on the top of the ball. They move to the bottom. They move toward the gold leaves. And because each gold leaf now has the identical charge, they repel each other, and they fly out at a certain angle. So I haven't even touched the electroscope. I just brought the charged rod near it. And I bring it away, and the whole process reverses, and the gold leaf sheath will collapse. So far, I'm about to go another step with that, but if I stop right there, I know what's happening. The electrostatic repulsion of positive charges on the rod versus the positive charges that are on the rod of the electroscope, the plastic rod, and the electroscope metal rod, those positive charges get repelled down to the bottom where the gold leaves are.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The part about that gives me problem, Glenn, is that metal rod coming out of the electroscope, if I put my ohm meter from the top to the bottom of that rod, I'd probably measure a few micro ohms. It's a large diameter metallic object, probably silver plated. No, it's probably chrome plated, or it's made out of stainless steel, but it's a reasonably beefy rod, and it's probably only got a couple of milliohms or micro-ohms of resistance from top to bottom. How in the world can I make those positive charges go down to the bottom of that rod just because I brought my charged plastic rod close to the top of it? How do I displace those positive charges without the micro-ohms between the rod shorting that out and stopping it from happening? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, I think you have to look at the plate by itself. In other words, they're equally spaced plates across the dielectric, and you have two of these plates, and what's happening is as the motion of each plate moving across the other, they're moving in opposite directions from each other. One is moving clockwise, and one is moving counterclockwise, so there is an inherent charge between those metal plates as they're moving. So if they're moving in opposite directions to each other, the charge is being shared, broken and open, and what you're doing is you're only completing the charge cycle on one pair of those plates on either side. So what's setting the polarity initially between the plates is the connection on one of the plates, but it's the motion as you move from plate to plate to plate to plate is being basically displaced across all of the plates as you move the plates apart. They're not moving apart. They're moving side to side in counter rotation. So if you look at the charge across any two plates across the, what's the spacing on those things? I think it's quite a few inches. And if you look at the charge between there with that motion, and then you're making the interconnection, it just basically moves the charge across the plates one by one, and you're basically creating that motion. So as the voltage is building up, because you have another charging device on the other side that's actually capturing charge, and the voltage on that builds up, and then that's basically being added to the charge on the plates as the Wilhelmhurst machine is being rotated. So it's really the separation of the plates, the dielectric, and the motion. So the rubbing motion is actually the wiping on each piece of copper plate as you're rotating that wheel. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Hold on now, Glenn. You jumped back to the Wilhelmhurst machine. I started talking about an electroscope. That's the machine that looks like Erlenmeyer flask in some cases, with a plastic, with a rubber stopper in the top. A rod goes through the middle of that rubber stopper. There's a small ball on the top of that rod coming outside of the flask. Inside the flask, the rod goes through the rubber stopper, and the bottom of that rod is a pair of gold leaf sheets. And as I charge a plastic rod by rubbing fur on it, and then bring the plastic rod close to the upper ball of the electroscope, assuming my plastic rod that I just rubbed the fur on is positively charged, I've now got a lot of positive charged particles on that thing. I bring it near the metal rod of the electroscope. The positive charges moved away, they get repelled, and they go down to the gold leaves, and they separate the gold leaves because they're both positively charged. And my question right now, this is the first step. Here, many steps downrange, we're going to get back to the Wilhelmhurst machine, but on the electroscope, I'm having trouble understanding how I get a whole lot of positive charge at the bottom of the metal rod of the electroscope. I get a bunch of negative charges, so to speak, on the top of the rod, and the rod has got micro-ohms of resistance. How am I moving that charge on that metal rod of the electroscope without it being shorted out by the micro-ohms of that rod? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, I think what's happening is you have an area in spacing. In other words, the rod itself should be negatively charged, right? In other words, if you're taking a dielectric and you're rubbing some kind of fur object on it, you're rubbing the electrons off that. So in other words, you have basically a negatively charged item at a relatively high charge. Now, you're bringing it close to those other leaves, so those leaves are looking more positive in charge over distance. So, in other words, is your question, in other words, what is the circuit loop at that point? Or, in other words, are you trying to determine where is the differential charge? In other words, the differential charge is the air between the bottle, the charged rod, and the area spacing between, in other words, there is an area loop. In other words, if you have to draw a cross-section across that whole area, and as you bring that rod close by, there is a charged loop between, in other words, it's almost like two plates of a capacitor. But in other words, because there's no effective current flow, or the current flow is so light, you have the differential charge, like the area between the spacing of a capacitor. Here again, I know my explanation here without drawing on a board or something is very, very poor. Back to you, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
I have a thought, Dick.
I've forgotten the name of the series where you list all of the possible dielectric materials. Plastic, mylar, Teflon, mica, skin, fur. You list all of the materials, and you can put them in a particular order. It's not the galvanic series. It's got I can't think of the name of the proper name for it. Anyhow, depending on what pair of materials you choose, depending on how far the materials are separated on that chart, on that vertical column of materials, depending on how far apart they are, determines the rate at which you get a differential charge when you rub one against the other. Depending on what materials you use, you can make the rod in your hand become positively charged or negatively charged. So there's no particular favored polarity. It's just a matter of what materials you've chosen on that particular series of materials. So in my example, assume my plastic rod did become positively charged and my fur became negative, and I took the fur and brought it out of the room, and I got this plastic rod in my hand where the end of it has got a high positive charge, and I bring it over to the upper ball of my electroscope, and the electroscope, the active circuit of the electroscope is the metallic rod, the vertical metallic rod that's got a small ball on the top and it's got gold leaves on the bottom, and it's all suspended in a rubber stopper. That is the circuit. The jar that it's in is not part of the circuit. I know because I own some electroscopes that have got a great big container, and some of them have a small container. They behave the same. I could, if I want to, take that rubber stopper and suspend it in the air with pieces of thread, and there's no glass or no container around the electroscope anymore, and I would get the exact same operation. So it's not the container. It is the gold leaves, the rod, and the fact that it's insulated. But I bring my plastic rod in my hand close to the top of the rod of the electroscope, and in my example, my plastic rod is positively charged. The positive charges on the top of the ball of the electroscope get repelled. They go down to the bottom where the gold leaf are. They crawl onto the gold leaves. The two gold leaves are now positively charged, repel each other, and they swing out at a 45-degree angle compared to the vertical, each one. And my first question is, how in the world did I move that charge? Positive charge went down to the bottom of the electroscope to the leaves. You could say the negative charge went to the top. And the rod itself, where I'm displacing the charge, has got micro-ohms of resistance. How did I displace the charge without it being shorted out by that metallic rod? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Okay, I see where you're coming from. The electroscope itself has a net charge of itself. In other words, it has a... rod is away from there. Let's keep the rod. Just look at the electroscope by itself. There is a certain base charge within it that's considered neutral. So that this way, those gold leaves are in the down position. So it's at one state of charge. What's happening now is that you're basically taking another capacitance. In other words, basically by bringing those to get the resistance, in this particular case. Now you bring a positively charged item near the ball. Now what's happened is you're displacing a charge over a distance next to between the ball and the rod. So now some of that charge is being displaced on the top, which is disturbing the charge balance inside the jar and the gold leaves. So now what you're doing is you're creating basically two capacitors in space with sharing displaced charge. That's really what all that's happening there, Dick, and that's why those gold leaves are moving out. So in other words, there's no circuit there. It's basically just displaced charge.
I found the material. It's called triboelectric series. You look up the word triboelectric, and you'll see a long list of materials. And depending on how far your particular materials are separated, like you might choose a rabbit fur and polyester and PVC pipe. PVC pipe, by the way, can build up some huge amounts of charge. Oh boy! And I've seen that arcing and sparking under a certain circumstance. So I got a PVC pipe in my hand. I got a piece of lamb's wool or something like that in my other hand. I rub one to the other, and now my PVC pipe is highly positively charged. And is that one plate of a capacitor, and the metal rod of the electroscope is the other plate of a capacitor? Yes, I could say that. But I'm making no contact yet to the rod of the electroscope. And by the way, if I did make contact, and by the way, the electroscope rod starts off neutral, and its total charge remains neutral. I'm not adding or subtracting any electrons or protons or whatever to the metallic structures of the electroscope. It remains overall neutral. But when I bring my PVC pipe near the top end of it, I get a displacement of charge between the top and the bottom of the metallic rod of the electroscope. How in the world am I getting a bunch of positive charge on the bottom of the electroscope near the leaves and a bunch of negative charge at the top of the electroscope near the ball on the top, and the resistance between the two is micro-ohms? How in the world does that circuit not get shorted out? Over to you on that one first, Glenn, K2LAW.
The same way across any dielectric boundary in a capacitor works. In other words, if you were to take a multi-layer capacitor and you were to look at the first layer of charge versus the second layer of charge versus the third layer of charge, you don't need to charge the outside of a capacitor to displace all of the charge across the outside leads. If I were to take a capacitor, just let's say a multi-layer, and had a tap in it, and I were to place charge and charge up one plate of that capacitor inside its structure, and as long as the dielectric constant is continuous across that plate, I will displace the charge across the whole capacitor, including the plates on the other side going to the other end. So the charge will displace across the whole dielectric, even though I'm only feeding it across part of it. Almost very, very similarly, like a winding in a transformer. If you think of a winding in a transformer, and you put a voltage on one side, and basically the voltage, both seconds, wind up across the whole transformer. Similarly, in a multi-layer dielectric, if you were to displace charge across one part of the dielectric, you will have displacement. There again, if you have a displaced charge on a rod and you bring it close to another displaced dielectric on the other side, what you're doing is you're moving displaced charge across that whole network, and then the dielectric constant of air in between it doesn't displace anything because its dielectric constant is so low by comparison to the dielectric constant between the rod and the jar. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Okay, you're saying there's a capacitor in air between my PVC rod and the metallic rod of the electroscope. There is a similar experiment that I've seen a YouTube video on, and I think it was also done at MIT in one of their electro laboratories, or was it at Stanford or Berkeley, one or the other. Anyhow, one of these lectures, you see a guy taking a Leyden jar. This is a Leyden jar which has a five-sided cup. There's a metallic cylindrical cup for the bottom. A plastic cup is the next layer, and an inner metallic cup with a great big rod coming out of the center of it, which has got a hook and a ball on the end of it. That is a Leyden jar. and I could ground the outer cup, outer metallic cup of that Leyden jar with some kind of a charge device. I put a whole bunch of kilovolts on the center metallic cup, and now I've got a charged Leyden jar, and I could put a shorting bar across it and draw a nice big arc. There's no two ways about it. There's an arc. There's a lot of voltage, a lot of charge built up, stored in that total Leyden jar. Let me drop. Now assume that the bottom outer metallic cup of this Leyden jar is held down with some kind of a device on the table. I come along with a plastic rod. I hook the plastic rod through the hook on the top of the inner metallic cup, and I lift it in the air. I have separated the inner cup from the outer cup. Inner cup, outer cup, inner cup, metal, outer cup, metal. I've separated one from the other. I now slide my hand along that plastic rod in my hand, and I touch the upper metallic cup. Nothing happens. I put my hand over to the lower metallic cup, the one that was attached to the table. Nothing happens. I put my fingers onto the plastic cup that is on the inside, and I lift it out. I now have I have three components sitting on this insulated table. The outer metallic cup, the inner metallic cup. As I move my fingers around on the plastic cup, I seem to sense a little bit of charge, but nothing significant. I then reassemble the thing. I then put the plastic cup inside of the outer metallic cup, and with my long plastic rod, I lower the inner metallic cup inside of the plastic cup. And then I do a test, and I draw a great big arc. You're led to believe that the stored energy was in the plastic. It was not in the metallic pieces. And only when it's reassembled do you sense the voltage of that charge, and you can draw an arc. I wonder if you've seen that video, and explaining that one is not easy. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I haven't seen that video, Dick, but I guess one of the interesting things to study, where you can really see this whole reaction taking place, is looking at multi-layer capacitors and understanding, you know, it's looking at the equations in multi-layer capacitors and how the charge is displaced across the dielectric in multiple layers. And there's some very, very interesting equations for that and how that works with area and width. And if you understand the first layer to the second layer, that coupling between two types of layered dielectric, and then watch what actually how the charge displaces itself. Many of these other things become less mysterious because charge will always displace across dielectrics, and it's a differential thing. And where the charge builds up, and you move another dielectric next to it, if it's especially if there's similar type of dielectric, you'll build up the same charge right next to it, and it will share. And there's no circuit. It's really just basically the charge is just displacing across more mass. Is really all that it is. It's very, very interesting stuff, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You're absolutely right. Everything I read leads me to believe that all the magic takes place within the dielectric and the displacement of the charges within the dielectric. You think you're putting charge on the positive plates versus the negative plates. Not really. You're putting charge on the dielectric that's between the plates. Let's go back to the electroscope. I'm holding my PVC rod an inch away from the top of the electroscope. The two metallic leaves are separated 45 degrees to the right, 45 degrees to the left, and 90 degrees apart from each other. I take a clip lead that is grounded. I touch the top of the electroscope with the clip lead. What do you think happens? And I'm still holding my PVC rod in the exact same position, an inch away. I ground the top of the electroscope with a grounded clip lead. What do you think happens to the leaves of the electroscope when I do that? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I think as you described before, you're seeing them move apart, right? Because in other words, what's happening is the charge is now displacing between that jar and the rod and in between. So now you've got a displacement of charge in the jar and then between the rod and the ball, and it's all just kind of like displacing itself, and you're seeing the leaves reacting to the charge and then moving outward.
Okay, I confused you. Assume my electroscope, the metal rod of the electroscope, and it's plastic, and it's a rubber stopper, are suspended in air. They're not inside of a jar. Suspended in air. And I did that with threads going out to infinity. I bring my PVC rod close to the top of the electroscope, and I hold it 1 inch away. And I'm going to hold it 1 inch away for the next 2 minutes. The two leaves of the electroscope separate. While they're separated, while I'm holding the PVC rod there, I come along with a grounded clip lead, and I simply touch the top of the electroscope. Take my word for it, the two leaves will collapse when I do that. I grounded the electroscope, and the two leaves will collapse. I haven't moved my PVC rod. It's still an inch away. Are you with me so far, Glenn?
Yes, I am, Dick.
Okay. I remove the ground lead, and it's now far out of the picture. The two leaves of the electroscope are still collapsed. I now take the PVC rod that was an inch away, and I bring it 2 feet away. The two leaves of the electroscope will separate again. There's a bunch of YouTube videos that will show you that happening. Can you explain that one? I think I can. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, let's see what happens. In other words, first the charge is being brought over and being displaced by the rod into... you're seeing the deflection of the golden leaves, right? Then you're attaching the clip lead, it collapses, you move the rod away, and then all of a sudden it comes back. The motion of moving the rod away from the grounded lead is actually bringing the charge back out as you're moving the distance in air. So there's a reaction of that charge as that plastic rod is being moved away in area and seconds. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
The way it's explained, and this is really important when it comes to the way the Wimhurst machine takes place, the way it's explained on a number of science websites you can go to, is that the electroscope, before anybody touches it, is a thoroughly neutral item. When I bring my PVC rod near it an inch away, it's still a neutral item in total, but it's got displaced charge. The positive charge when moved down to the bottom, the negative charge moved up to the top when I brought over a positively charged PVC pipe. When I grounded it with the clip lead, the positive leads were being repelled by the positive particles on the electroscope were sensing the repulsion of the PVC pipe, positively charged, being nearby. The positive charges on the electroscope didn't like being there. The ground lead presented a path by which they could leave, and they left. A significant number of positive charges left the electroscope total. Even though I touched the top of it, they left in total. Now the electroscope is partially negatively charged, but the negative charge on the electroscope is being displaced in a funny way because of the presence of the nearby positively charged PVC pipe. But while the grounding lead is there, the two leaves, the gold leaves, collapse. But you've got a basically negatively charged item with what little bit of charge is left being displaced in a funny way so that the electric leaves, the gold leaves, are collapsed. Now I brought the grounding lead away. I now bring the PVC pipe away. The total charge on the electroscope is now negative because the positives were drained away by the ground lead.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The negative charge on the total electroscope is now negatively charged. The two leaves will now separate, not because of positive charge on them, because of negative charge on them. So now all I've done to go from the collapsed electroscope to a non-collapsed, separated leaves again, it's just to take the PVC pipe away with no grounding. I've now got a negatively charged electroscope. Nothing is near it. I bring the ground lead back for the second time without bringing the PVC pipe back, and I touch it to the top of the electroscope, and the deflected leaves collapse again. Ain't that crazy? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Not really, because it's my way of thinking that's how the charge is conserved. In other words, because basically what happened was you brought over the positive charge, you grounded it, and then what happened was when you removed the ground lead, you moved it away again, and the motion of moving it away again moved the charge back in the other direction. So this way the charge is always conserved across the dielectric, but in two opposite polarities. That's really all that's happening there. And instead it's really just that polarity in space and then moving it away. So, yeah, it's cool stuff. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.